This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level, Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This warms your brain to a crispy and crunchy 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flutter statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Is it working, Cal? Can you feel it?
Worms.
And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BitCop no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BitCop.org. So, it's been a couple of weeks since we've spoken, Cal. By the way, everybody, I'm Lou. What's been going on? We haven't chatted in a while. Anything exciting going on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always up to date with the news and everything as much as you are. So it's comical to see the latest things that are that come out there, like the crap hole countries. I guess personally, you know, you had New Year's and all that stuff since the last time we talked. I think for me, for my New Year's would be reaching out to a lot more people and bringing them towards the Missions of Liberty here in my home city of Richmond. And I don't always have fun talking to people and doing that. You know, we have our freedom gatherings. And I think that's, let's see if I could bring in maybe 20 more people this year. What about you? Do you have any New Year's resolutions? Do you do any of that?
I don't really do New Year's resolutions. I figure if you're going to change something, the calendar has nothing to do with it. You just change it.
Oh, come on. It's part of the ritual.
Yeah, I'm not really feeling too ritualistic about it.
You go by the Chinese New Year? It's 4,000 years old instead.
Yeah, I'd like to get out to one of those gatherings that you have out there. I'd like to get out there to Anarchon because it's probably a two-day drive for me to get out to Richmond, Virginia, where you are. How long does it take you to get to Detroit when you come up here? It's probably a good 10 hours, right? You there?
Fiend phone.
Are you there, Cal? Okay. Well, Cal has disappeared. He's trying to get back. So, Yeah, the outreach that he was talking about, and for those that aren't familiar with Cal's work, he does a lot of man-on-the-street interviews, and particularly going out and talking to the,
Fiend
to the
phone.
Local
Fiend
advocates
phone.
Of communism, the folks that think that the world would be a better place if people didn't have to share the product of their labor with those that didn't earn it, meaning the capitalists. But yet the same selling point of communism is that people will share their labor with each other, whether they earned it or not. So, are you back, Cal?
Yeah.
Okay.
I pushed my hand on the USB cord here, and apparently that disconnected it. So, moving the hand away from that.
Well, at least your cat didn't eat your internet.
I know, right? How many cats does Michael have? 20?
He says 3, but I smell crazy cat lady, so it's probably a lot more. He only shows pictures of 3.
Right. Yeah, not so the ones that live outside his house, right? Alley cats.
Yeah. He probably has, like, boxes of them down in the basement. When he needs a couple extra, he takes them out and lets them run around and puts them away when he's done playing with them. But right. So, yeah, I was just talking about your outreach while you had disappeared. And I used to enjoy doing the man-on-the-street stuff and engaging people. And I don't know. I've kind of fallen away from it. Not completely. I haven't sworn it off, but I'm really at a point where, how could I put it? If you picture somebody trying to feed a baby and the baby's holding his mouth tight, shut really tight, and making the squishy face like, no, I don't want it. That's how I feel talking to a lot of people about individual freedom and self-ownership, because they're just squeezing their pursing their lips closed, they got their jaw clenched, and they just have absolutely no interest in it whatsoever. And that's kind of how I feel. So it gets a little bit frustrating, but from what I've seen of your videos, particularly talking to the commies, because that's always a hoot. You're pretty darn good at it.
Yeah, I have a lot of fun with it. I have made a lot of friends from it. I have a roommate upstairs who we wouldn't be friends if I didn't go out there, and we found each other while spreading anarchy. So I hadn't done it in the past couple months because the audio on my camera just kept broken, but I just bought a new one. It just came in the mail Monday, and I'm excited to take it out. I think the first place I'm going to go there would be Washington, D.C., in front of the White House, maybe next week, and take it out for a test run.
If you want to engage commies, that's the place to go.
That's the place to go.
But that's soft communism there.
Yeah. I mean, it's you're dealing with people that don't even know what communism is, or much less capitalism. And you had that Rupert study report from Reason.com talking about millennials and their inability to figure out what is capitalism, what is socialism. So, you know, when I go out there, just my train of thought is that, you know, these people just don't know. And so it's difficult for me to be frustrated then with people who don't know what's going on.
I haven't seen that article.
I'll send it to you after. I'm going to write a note here.
Are you up on it enough to talk about it?
Yeah, so like it just came out. So like there were like these questionnaires that were passed out to millennials and the target audience. And many of the questionnaires in which the respondents would reply with would be such as, you know, things that they would be thinking that were socialism, but in fact, like more conservative or release controls in the market, and things that would be more, more capitalism were actually more socialist policies. So they found out like that the people that they were interviewing and responding to these questionnaires didn't even know what capitalism or socialism is. But in their ways, like they will find like some of these legislation pieces to be very favorable, although they say they're anti-capitalist, but they're like more free market leaning, and the inverse. Kind of in the same vein, there's this guy that went out there and started talking to these students, asking, you know, if they like these tax cuts, these tax programs, saying that they came from Bernie Sanders, and they're like, oh yeah, you know, these are fantastic, you know, and then come to realize that these are from Trump, right? So most people don't really know what's going on, much less can figure out, you know, this a good definition for these things. And I don't think it's their fault. I think the government's done a good job and confusing people and having these kind of mixed definitions in terms of like mixing up abstract and concrete concepts, saying like things like the social contract is something that's real, like a living, breathing document. And so it's, you know, you warp their reality, you know, so it's hard enough. You know, you go 12 years of schooling and they don't give you a good definition for much less anything. So yeah, I think you're going to have problems with it. And I just have fun talking about these things, and I think it's a good way to go about it.
I recently
having
had
fun
a,
with it.
It's interesting that you bring that up. I recently had a conversation with somebody, and this guy, his family immigrated to the USSA from somewhere in Asia. I don't know which country specifically, but I assume that it was probably one of those commie Schumer holes over there. But anyway, this guy's fairly well-to-do, and he lives out in California, so he's a California liberal and self-described socialist, and he wants European-style socialism. He's not so far gone as the folks that you were talking about, because it sounds like if the government went in and implemented full wage and price controls and nationalized industries, it sounds like they would define that as laissez-faire capitalism and totally unfettered free market, which is rather on the nonsensical side. But after a little going back and forth, I was able to pin the guy down a little bit, and he says, well, you know, it's not real socialism, it's a mixed economy, which is a typical answer. But the one thing that I could not get him to answer was a very simple question, and I think this is something that is going to be common amongst all the progressives out there, or at least a good majority of them. And what I asked him was, okay, so you see this as being the best way to do things. He's an advocate of a national healthcare system, because every industrialized country in the world has one, but not that that's really an argument for it. It's more the Me Too fallacy. So it's not an argument that it works, but he's under the belief that if you have this program, then people are going to have what they're looking for, because people associate government programs with the results that they promise, not the tragedy that they actually provide. And my question was, because we both want to see people have access to health care. I don't know anybody that says, you know what, all those poor people out there, I hope that's impossible for them to get health care. I don't know anybody in this category. There may be somebody out there. I don't know. I'm not going to say it's impossible, but I don't think it's highly likely that somebody's saying, I don't want anybody to have access to health care. I want them to suffer. It just doesn't happen. So I said, The question was, we have a common goal here. We both want the same thing. You believe that a parasitic socialistic program that leeches off of the productive economy and then redistributes wealth into the unproductive economy is the best way to do it. Okay, that's fine. I, however, see it differently. I see the mutual benefit societies of the past and the charities and the different organizations and all the things that happened prior to all the interventions of where government took over the healthcare industry and brought us to where we are today. I see that as the way of doing things. I see the decentralization. I see the cutting costs by removing barriers to entry. So he's like, well, you know, kind of teetering on it. He's like, okay, so you're not that evil. But the question is, if I see a better way of doing things, and that's how I want to live my life, and that's where I want to focus my efforts and my resources, meaning not pay tax dollars into the system that he wants, but to have an actual free market, what should my punishment be for that? And I couldn't get him to answer on how I should be punished for wanting freedom and voluntary cooperation. We'll be back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is Michael W. Dean's novel from the year 2000. It's entirely fictional.
Allegedly.
Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is a glorious story about a low-rent post-punk rock star, Cash Newman. Cash Newman is entirely made up.
Not a guarantee.
And is not based on any particular person.
Not a guarantee.
Cash Newman has lots of fun with strange ladies and with the party favors.
Don't try this at home.
And he hangs out with people who commit 3 felonies a page.
But that's none of my business.
It's all in good fun. And at the same time, it's kind of deep. But always spunky. Michael recently updated the book to a much better version. He released it as a paperback and for the first time on Kindle. As with this and all Freedom Fiends related things, please rate and review. Get Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women now on Amazon or at michaelwdean.com.
For entertainment purposes only.
Freedom Fiends, and we are back. This is Lou and Cal. Talking about talking economics. Don't do it. It's painful. It's horrible. When we went to break, I was talking about a recent conversation I had had with a California progressive, and he would not answer the question of what my punishment should be for wanting to try market-based things for creating a system where people would have access to health care. He's one of these people that believes that the free market led by the government has obviously failed or something like that because there is too much laissez-faire. It's kind of like the free unfettered market that we had under George Bush. So when you're dealing with, when you're talking to these folks, Cal, because you do a lot of this outreach out there, what are you finding as far as these objections to trying freedom and trying market-based stuff? And have you ever done the against me argument of, you know, are you willing to use violence against me to get what you want?
No, I never really had to go that far with the against me thing, actually. Maybe in the first few months, I don't know, maybe in the first year, at the end of the year, when I heard about that, I was like trying that one out. But I just kind of gets, I mean, it's personable, of course, you know, of course it is. What I find what ends up happening is that a lot of these people just don't know the history of how the market had worked. In terms of like friendly societies and the mutual aid societies, and how these things help to alleviate poverty and those types of you know, bad situations that you don't want to be in, and people were able to bounce right back up from poverty. You know, you didn't have to wait so long for that. Poverty rates were declining next to nothing before Lyndon Johnson came into office and with his war on poverty programs.
And then they started increasing again.
Right, the opposite happened. Right. So a lot of these people just don't know the history. And I find, you know, it's mostly with liberals, they find it difficult to understand this part of history. But, you know, with conservatives, they have, you know, let the market provide these kind of services. But even in the market sense, a lot of people don't realize, you know, there's a government cap, a limit for doctors. And that, you know, doesn't help to drive down prices. And so when you have that kind of bottleneck pressure, you're not going to have like the availability of many doctors out there that can, you know, with that kind of competition, drive down prices. So it's...
Yeah. And the story behind that, sorry to cut you off, the story behind the cap on doctors is about a third of the medical schools that existed in the 20th century were shut down by government regulators at the behest and urging of the AMA. And the reason for that, the stated reason was for quality control, because these were bad medical schools and they're putting out low quality doctors. And the actual reason was it was capping the number of doctors, thus creating a supply shortage to meet the demand, thus causing prices to go up. When I hear about this, well, quality. Well, if you get the sniffles, do you really need to go to the Mayo Clinic? Do you really need to go to the top doctor in the area for minor stuff? So less skilled doctors, yeah, I think there's a spot for them. And quite frankly, I don't think you have complete derelicts graduating medical school. And that's just me, but they don't exactly. Understand that. Yeah, they don't understand that regulation reduced the number of doctors since 1953. I think it was. I saw a statistic. The population of the U.S. has done a little bit more than doubled in that time, but the number of new doctors that are going out in the world each year has only increased by 10% from then to now.
Right. So there you go. You know, that's something a lot of people don't know about. And that's, I think that's the thing that's kind of missing with a lot of their understanding about, you know, oh, the market, you know, history, you know, so it's the same reason why, you know, when the government will not talk about market successes in government history books, because that's the last thing that they want to show, right? The last thing they want to talk about when they talk about, you know, the post office or, you know, government monopolies is Lysander Spooner and his success with the American Litter Mill Company. And so these are things that, you know, will go the opposite of government, showing like the market can provide these things, that people can find this kind of independence, that people can find a way to live successfully without government. And that kind of independence is the last thing government wants or wants to kind of project or help, you know, put out there with that kind of notion and idea. So with healthcare, it's I kind of bring up a lot of those points, and these are things that just people just don't know.
How receptive to are they to this new information, such as the medical schools being shut down or the mutual benefit societies?
Very receptive. They're always very keen to want to receive more information on that, especially the friendly societies, which is another thing that government shut down.
We'll be back.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Biptunia, music for the drive to Alpha Centauri. Biptunia's influences are Gary Numan, Brian Eno, Pink Floyd, David Bowie, Led Zeppelin, Grateful Dead, Frank Zappa, Robert Fripp, Blondie, Kraftwerk, and Dead Kennedys. Biptunia styles are trip-hop, rock, pop, glam, industrial, ambient, jazz, and space. Plus, it's got cats and is covered by the BIPCOT NoGov license. You can download Biptunia's music free. Go to biptunia.com. That's B-I-P-T-U-N-I-A. Bravo, India, Papa, Tango, Uniform, November, India, Alpha. Biptunia.com.
And we are back. This is Lou and Cal, and we are talking about talking to commies. So it's rather interesting telling people about the history of how healthcare was provided, or how charity and even unemployment benefits were provided before these things were nationalized and socialized by government. It's really fun to ask these folks, well, before government got involved, because really the beginning of government involvement in healthcare was started in the Great Society with the Medicare and Medicaid that started up and getting involved in just a lot of different other stuff. That's when government really became a direct provider of medical benefit. Also, insurance was starting to get more and more, I don't want to say popular, but it was definitely a lot more prolific, is not the word. It took on a much bigger role, but it also did that as a result of the wage and price controls in World War II. But I asked people, how do you think healthcare was delivered prior to all this government intervention? And you would think that they would say something like, well, they died in the streets and they were stacked by cordwood. And when the stack got tall enough, people came and burned the bodies. And it's, but they don't have an answer. They just give you that doe in the headlights look, you know, like they're deer and you're a car coming at them. They just have absolutely no clue. They don't think about it. So what are you finding? You said that you've had a positive response from when you talked to them about the friendly societies and things like that. How did that go? How was that conversation?
I think the best place to kind of remind a lot of these people is how it's not saving your health or much your life when you have to be first be threatened at gunpoint to sign up for Obama's healthcare plan, because these conversations were occurring well before Trump came into office. So that was, of course, during Obama's time, when he was threatening people with fines if they went to sign up with his website that did not work at the time for a long time. And so a website, of course, that, there's like conservative estimates at the time in 2014, there was like around like $600 million. There's like a Bloomberg report say that it exceeded $2 billion. We had everything up. So even for a website that doesn't work, threatening people, threatening their health, right? If they don't sign up for a healthcare plan, it's kind of ridiculous. And I think these kinds of hypocritical stances is helpful in showing them that the government is not really particularly there in terms of regarding health, or much less capable to do it. And of course, on the topic of Obama, really quickly, tangent, in terms of healthcare, if anyone here remembers Obama bombing two field hospitals, Doctors Without Borders.
Yeah.
Remember, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He bombed them, field hospital, Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan. And he murdered, I believe, like nearly two dozen doctors and patients. Gone. There's no trial for any of that, of course, right? So you can't really tell me that, there's a vested interest in government and want to protect your health. And, they've done a lot to kind of take that away from a lot of people permanently. And So, yeah, I think the conversation goes really well when you take a lot of these things into account. Or even if you want to take it in more, they want to look for facts and things like that. You know, well, factually, you know, first the government has to threaten your life, threaten your health through taxes before they can make the claim that they're there to protect your health or safeguard your life, right? So, but yeah, the conversations after going through a lot of these things that they've never heard of, things that their 1984 classrooms will never talk about. It's fruitful. I find it helpful. They don't want to hear pull up your bootstraps. They don't want to hear any of that stuff. I think it's like going delving into the history of these things, of how mutual aid societies worked until the government came in with their code inspectors, and that's not up to code. You're going to get fined. You're going to lose your license, and shut them all down. And
you have to have a license to provide this service. So,
right.
And what's interesting is these people hate corporatism. They absolutely hate it. Also, to them, corporatism is completely one-sided. They will say things like, well, these evil corporations are buying off our politicians, and they will never say that our politicians are selling themselves to these corporations. So it's always one-sided on the blame there. And quite frankly, if politicians didn't have favors to sell in the first place, I think corporations, lobbyists, and every other boogeyman out there would be rendered relatively harmless. And outside providing some bad service here and there, you really wouldn't have to worry about a whole lot. But it's that protection that is afforded to them by politicians through regulation. And I just don't really see them being able to grasp that. And just as an example, you look at the mutual benefit societies that did exist, and they provided health care coverage, they provided unemployment insurance, they covered poverty assistance. They handled everything, and it was dirt cheap. But the insurance companies came in, and they lobbied for regulation to get these organizations shut down, saying, hey, you're not an insurance company, so you can't provide these type of benefits because what you do is like insurance. As a matter of fact, before Obamacare even was passed, there was stories of doctors that said, you know what, you pay our office X number of dollars per month, you can come in, you get as many visits as you need. We'll take care of this. There might be a charge for really heavy duty extravagant stuff, but you pay $100 a month and that covers your family. And they got shut down for doing that because it was mimicking insurance, and they weren't licensed to provide that type of a service. And these folks, they don't see the crushing of options and alternatives by their politicians as being disruptive to the healthcare system and the services provided, and making it more difficult for the poor that they care so much about to be able to get these vital services. So I've always had a hard time getting them to get past that hump. It's kind of like they have a reset button or default setting, and you hit the reset button and they go back to that default setting of, but government has to do it. Government has to provide the service.
There are some people, though, who will try to use like the example, like, but what if my son is dying and he's a cure and it's right across the street? Would you not break in and, steal the cure? As if to say, same thing with healthcare, right? My son is dying and he's this healthcare. It's like, when you talk about reaching out to your friends and neighbors about it, right? Start a GoFundMe campaign, start a Kickstarter. This guy got like $1,000 just to like make a potato recipe or something like that.
Have you ever thought of knocking on the door and asking for it, telling your story?
Yeah, exactly. But then water down, move the goalposts and say, no. But what if you're like an extreme situation? It's like an extreme situation where you can't use your mouth and talk to people and ask for help. It's like, I think we have a lot more.
I gotta interrupt you. I gotta interrupt you. There's a story. I know I've told it before, but I just absolutely love telling this story. I remember seeing this online petition. There was a kid. He took out like, I don't know, he had like $20,000 in student loans or something like that. And the kid passed away. Because his mother was the co-signer for the student loan, she got stuck with it because she says, well, if he's not able to pay it off, then as a co-signer, I will do that. And the poor kid passed away. It was like car accident, something like that. I don't remember exactly how he died, but he died. So there's this online petition saying if we can get 10,000 signatures for the government to forgive this loan, they will forgive this woman's loan and she won't have to pay back this money. And I'm thinking to myself, you stupid bottle-fed idiots. If each of you that signed it kicked in $2, it would be done. But that never even occurred to them. And I've seen commercials where people are standing around looking at a piece of crumbled up paper laying on the ground beside the garbage can, and everybody's just standing there just with their mouths open, awestruck, like it's a crime scene, like somebody just got butchered, and everybody's looking at this crumbled up piece of paper on the ground next to the garbage can, and then somebody comes up, picks it up, puts it in the garbage can, and everybody's acting like, oh my God, I can't believe you actually accomplished that. Yeah, it's amazing how people have become domesticated house pets like that. It's just, it boggles the mind. All right, end rant.
No, but Baloo, if you're not forced to pay taxes, no one will help each other.
Yeah, I'm really not feeling that, particularly in, and I don't know if I talked about this with you, but I know I've talked about this on the show here. There's the local clergy association has put together a little homeless program here in the area. There's no regular shelter, homeless shelter, or anything like that. So the clergy association has done a rotating shelter where each church will handle it for a week, and they've got a van that will go pick people up in the community and take them, and they'll provide them overnight shelter and meals and everything else, and it's 100% privately funded, and the donations, there's enough large private donations coming in right now that they don't even have to do bake sales or actually solicit for donations. They came up with a van to literally go up and down the highway through probably three or four different cities, pick people up, take them over to the churches, and the meals, those are coming from parishioners or other volunteers. They're making up meals and they're bringing them on down there. It's nothing fancy. They might get a bag lunch with a sandwich and a little bag of chips for the next day, but they're getting fed and everything else. And the toughest part about setting that program up was to get all the various permissions from government to help people. When you look at all the help that does happen, even while government is providing the service, it's hard to say that it wouldn't happen without government. I don't see how they track that. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Are you tired of stinky socialists trying to take over America?
And are you also tired of theorists talking about the free market as a cure-all for every problem with no firsthand experience of how the market actually works?
Well, the Truth, Justice, American Way app gives you wall-to-wall shows by hosts who not only understand the market, but tell you how they make money in a variety of patriotic endeavors.
The Truth, Justice, American Way app for Android is 24/7 streaming audio content on the topics of finance, liberty, self-defense, and technology.
All the hosts are all American Americans from all over America.
And the app is made in Wyoming, the cowboy state.
Because you should buy American, even with free Android apps.
Truth, Justice, American Way. Useful information, compelling personalities, and superior American audio quality.
Go on the Google Play Store or the Amazon App Store and search Truth, Justice, American Way.
God bless each and every one of you, and God bless America.
Yeah.
Freedom Fiends, and we are back. This is Lou and Cal, and there's a story that I read a while back. It was Frank Chodoroff. Are you familiar with Frank Chodoroff, Cal?
No, I'm not.
Okay, he was probably, I think his era was maybe the 50s or so, maybe a little bit before that. And I think he would fall in the old right, maybe libertarian-ish, possibly classical liberal category. Not really sure, but I guess he was having a discussion, and a student asked him, says, "But what about the poor?" And he says, "Well, it's simple. It'll go like it used to be. They'll die in the streets and we'll push them in the river." And the student says, "That never happened." And his response was, "Exactly."
Oh, that's so good.
And the whole purpose behind it, and we spent the whole first hour talking, our opening segment banter turned into a first hour of show topic. Where do people get these ideas that nothing would happen without the government, in spite of the actual history? And I think we concluded that a lot of it is ignorance. It's definitely a lack of information. That sort of information is not going to be available in the government schools. Religious schools teach religion. Trade schools teach trade. Government schools teach, guess what? Government. So I guess one of the big things is, how do we combat that? Those of us who believe in freedom and do believe in market-based solutions, and also want to see people taken care of.
Yeah, you mentioned something about the church earlier in charity, and the church plays an enormous big part in charity and helping a lot of people out with food pantries and things like that. It's funny, a lot of these people who pander that, you know, society will crumble without nationalized health service, all that stuff, are the same kinds of people that says, you know, don't talk about philosophy, don't talk about educating people, or talking about, you know, facts and this kind of, have these kind of conversations when people are starving. And, you know, it's difficult to say that, you know, starving here versus, you know, places like Venezuela, and places Venezuela where they beat cows to death if they find it to eat, to storm zoos, that's starving. And I might go hungry, you know, I was hungry like maybe an hour ago, you know. But, you know, when I look around my city here in Richmond, there's dozens and dozens of food pantries of charities, a lot of them run by the church. And you'll find the same case in many, many major cities. You know, there's a lot of people out there, you know, a lot of philanthropy. And the church gives out about tens of billions and billions of dollars every year. There's a NASA philanthropy website, and it says Americans give away $390 billion in 2016. You know, there's a lot of money out there that people want to help each other. You know, these are...
But they do it for the tax write-off.
Right.
They're not really giving us the tax write-off. But interestingly enough, the number of people that itemize their deductions is pretty slim. So the money recouped from the donations through tax write-offs is rather negligible.
Yeah.
Anyway, continue. That,
They find that the most of the money from like high net worth people, like people with a lot of money, you think that would want to write off. You know, high net worth donors give up over $25,000 in charity, versus everyone else on average is about $2,500, right? So you know, it's people with money are, you know, one of the biggest philanthropists out there is the Bill Gates Foundation. You know, so there's a lot of this stuff out there. Again, you know, it's not just, you know, people think the government is the only people that can do this, but, you know, there's tons of money out there. There's billions of, you know, you have this Facebook feature. When it's your birthday, you can ask people to donate to a cause, right?
I don't think it's restricted to just birthdays either.
Right. Yeah. So there's definitely a lot of different places to get help. Government is not the place to find it, to seek it out. You know, look at your neighbors, look at your community, look at church.
Yeah. Build a the community. With the cuts to different programs, a lot of people have been bickering and complaining. I says, my advice to them is, well, maybe you should concentrate a little bit less on government and a little bit more on your community. Because it is out there, like you just said. We'll be back with the second hour. Maybe we'll talk about topics. Maybe we won't.
Worms.
Analytics.
Are you a political activist who does things that the government might not like? Then this free ebook may save your life. Rats is your guide to protecting yourself against snitches, informers, informants, agents provocateur, narcs, finks, and similar vermin. Rats was written by OG libertarian Claire Wolf. Rats is a short book, easy to read, and available free in many formats. Download Rats free at rats-nosnitch.com. That's rats-nosnitch.com.
This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's low orbit ion cannon high atop Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite LibPair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows for use by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. I'm Lou, and I'm joined by Cal. Welcome back, Cal. You are back, right?
Meowsers.
Meowsers, yes. So the first hour, our banter talked about the world before government took over everything, before it infested every essence of our being and nationalized and socialized everything. How would things be provided? And we talked about the mutual benefit societies that used to handle health care for the poor and for everybody else, and how it worked and how it was affordable. And then government happened. So the question that I asked at the end of the hour, and you started talking about it, and I want to go back to it a bit, is, all right, we know that a lot of people are ignorant of history, and I think it's also fair to say that they're blinded by the ideology of, well, government must do everything, must be in charge of this, because government is the only one that's capable, because the Constitution grants authority and capability and knowledge and wisdom and virtue, because you get all these votes, a spell of greatness is cast upon you by the wizard of the Constitution, and therefore you become like qualified or some nonsense. So as far as getting past that, you talked about doing outreach, and that's one of the things that you do quite a bit, is engaging people. Talk a little bit more about the engagement and spreading the message, evangelizing liberty and market-based solutions.
I think a lot of the arguments a lot of people have in regards, I've noticed, I used to have it too. And starting off would be talking about liberty and all these market solutions that just kind of go all over the place, one tangent after another. It's like a tough, you know, fish you're trying to reel in, and goes all over. The argument just flies everywhere, right? It's an ultimate move the goalpost kind of discussion.
And it's like reeling in a fish, like you said.
yeah. So I found it a fun way to do, I guess, like that Sesame Street character, Ernie. You know, Bert is trying to fish, and Ernie has like this, I think, harmonica or something, and the fish just jump right in the boat, and it's very easy to fish after that. So I have a fun, easier way to do it would be first to ask what the other person's positions are, their moral positions, on a couple of questions. If they think it's wrong or immoral to initiate force, if they think outside of self-defense, you know, what do you consider then violence, what the initiation of force to be wrong and immoral, and if it's wrong and immoral to violently force your ideas onto other people, and just about everyone except for like maybe one or two or three communists agree with that statement. And I found it then best after we agree and come to find what their moral positions are on the initiational force. We can then discuss government. And I paint a picture of what is government. And from there, government being defined as, you know, as a monopoly, right? But even more than that, just a monopoly on the goods and services you and I want. And not so much it's criminal and illegal for anyone to compete against those government services. So not only you're forced to fund them, like in Virginia, you have ABC. You have a government monopoly in distilled, retail, and wholesale of distilled spirits. So it's illegal and criminal for anyone in the whole state of Virginia to compete against ABC. So you're forced to fund it through taxes, and then you can't even compete. And that's what a government really is, as it functions. And then from there, all the other questions come in. Much easier, very easy to talk about it after that. Because then once you understand what government is and realize your position is against initiational force, and understand that government's funding comes from the initiational force, and then knows only how to resolve any problems through the initiational force, you find that it's the complete opposite of your moral principles to begin with. It it tricks you into compromising that. And then the questions will be, well, without government, you know, then comes, what about the roads? And those are easy then after that.
You must deal with healthcare? Some. You must deal with some very lazy commies, because I don't run into the people that have the moral problems with it. It's like, oh, they got to rob you? Well, give it up. You know what this is? Don't make it a murder. I mean, I'm sad to say, but
are you wearing an anti-Shay T-shirt on you too?
I've run into a fair number that they're just fine with, well, is for the good of society. So if a few people have to get killed by the IRS to teach the others to cooperate, and they don't understand the difference between cooperation and compulsion,
are most of these conversations on online though?
Mostly, probably, yeah.
Right, yeah. I think a lot of people behave differently in person than online. Right, online you have this kind of veneer. You can hide behind emoticons and, you know, I think a lot more people, a lot more on their toes in person, especially if there's a video camera. Because the video camera, you know, will showcase later on YouTube, right, otherwise. I've had like maybe two trolls before trying to be facetious, and then, you know, me pushing them for that, saying, okay, you know, this is kind of what you're advocating for, and, you know, yada yada, and then, you know, they realize that that's not really what they meant. You know, they don't want to hold a gun, they don't want to actually, you know, do any of that stuff, and, you know, they say they're just pretending, you know, and trying to back trail, because I told them that this is going to go on YouTube. So I think there's a sense of, I guess, mannerism, or a way that people comport themselves behind the screen and in front of it, that kind of helps me, I guess, talking in person. Because I find also sometimes the arguments behind a screen cannot be as fruitful. Well, for me, that is.
Yeah, I've seen less bloodlust in person than I have online. But don't get me wrong, there are people out there that they will, you can visibly see them hit their, go into panic mode, and they are triggered at the thought that the stuff might not happen. I mean, it's actually kind of scary. Most people won't foam at the mouth like they will online, because, as you mentioned, it does give you that anonymity, and you don't have to be as respectful and well behaved as you need to be in person. But I really see the physical discomfort that they go into when you start dropping these ideas on them.
I mean, I'm sure, like, places like Portland, you know, or Seattle, hotbed cities like these, you'll find a lot of people like that. So maybe it's the environment. You know, Richmond is, you know, goes back and forth. You know, there's a balance there. It's not completely commonized, as you find in places like Seattle or California, right? There is a place maybe in Virginia, Charlottesville might be our version of California. Virginia is California.
You mentioned, yeah, I that. Think, You mentioned in the past that you had similar objections to what you get from people today, and I've run into the same thing in having discussions with people. I've gotten the same objections that I gave in the past, and I looking back on it now, I really see that a lot of my objections to freedom were not actually they weren't really in opposition to freedom. It was about an ignorance of freedom. It was about an ignorance of how markets work. I remember when the housing bubble was popping back in, 2008. It started in 2007. The stock market declined, and it declined about 25% from October of 2007 to September of 2008. And then in October of 2008, it dropped like another 25%. So it was like a 50% drop over 1 year's time. But a majority of, or at least half of it, was in like a very short period of time. And I remember thinking to myself, oh gosh, maybe this unregulated free market capitalism has failed. And I had no idea about all the different things that were out there. I had no idea about how central banking worked and how playing around with the money supply can fuel the bubbles. It fuels the boom and bust of the business cycle. I had no idea about the Community Reinvestment Act and the policies that pushed mortgages to people that really couldn't afford them and probably shouldn't have had them. I bought into the notion that, well, the American dream is a home, whether you can afford it or not. You know, the American dream is whatever you want it to be. It's your dream. It doesn't have to be a collective dream, but because I was ignorant of the philosophy of freedom and how markets work and everything else, I bought into it. So I was just as much of a repeater as everybody else. And I found out that it wasn't a failure of free market capitalism, and we didn't have to, as George W. Bush says, abandon free market principles to save the free market. I realized that it wasn't a free market. I mean, at best, it was a market with an ankle bracelet on it and an orange jumpsuit. So far from free. But anyway, continue.
Absolutely. I like harping on that. Like, there's a lot of stuff about the housing market crash that I didn't know until like much later. My family got affected by that too. They lost a house on that. But you know, looking back, I could have, if I was there, I was in the military overseas, so I couldn't really be there and look at the documents and tell them, you cannot afford this. And I gave them power of attorney to use my credit, and in turn they weren't able to afford it, so they lost it. Ruined my credit, but able to bounce back. But yeah, when you look at the details and stuff like that, it's like, you know, the variable interest rates, the things that, you know, you look at, you know, what's your knowledge on economics or any of this stuff. And for a lot of this, well, it's like 30-minute video mandated by the government, and that's what you need to know. And for a lot of other people, not even having collateral to put down to get a loan. There's a lot of people who were on welfare getting loans that they shouldn't have not gotten loans. Well, because government, you know, it's looking at banks and saying, you know, you're possibly racist if you're not giving out money to, you know, a certain group of people. Not because they haven't not so much vested interest into or not. You know, the only money or the color of money that people care about is, you know, the color of your money, right? But yeah, it's devastated a lot of people that I know, personally affected through to my family. But yeah, a lot of things that you find the source of a lot of the social problems and illnesses, you can always point to government.
There's always a policy that causes problems. We'll be back.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Making the world a better place with Great Liberty Media is not easy, but it is effective. Making the world a better place with Great Liberty Media doesn't even pay very much at all. Sometimes we even have to pay out of our own pockets. But we do it because we have to, for you, and for the children. Here at the Freedom Fiends, we've been producing amazing and effective Liberty Media every day since 2011. Radio shows, podcasts, movies, music, cryptocurrencies, and yes, even memes. The Freedom Fiends also run the world's only Liberty Media Teaching Hospital and the world's only voluntarist media university. Our hands-on classes educate and shape hundreds of the great Liberty speakers of today and tomorrow, and they in turn will teach and inspire others. Heck, even the ones who got fired or quit in a huff still hold useful skills and equipment to hone their own Liberty Media and teach others. Freedom Fiends Media and our students' media is a rising groundswell to help create happy Liberty lives around the world and maybe even on to Alpha Centauri. Kitty cats and puppies like living in Liberty homes more than in statist homes. So please donate to the Freedom Fiends, if only for the kitties. Hashtag please donate Freedom Fiends, think of the kitties.
About how it used to be back in the olden days, and we're talking about how to spread the message of freedom and free markets and how the market actually did provide, and it provided quite well, but it didn't provide power to those who sought to expand their power. Therefore, the market had to go. I think when it comes to reaching out to people, I think it's a worthwhile activity. I think it's a good means of getting the word out there, but I think the best way to reach the most resistant is there's an old saying: necessity is the mother of invention, and I would also add that it's probably the greatest teacher. When it comes to finding solutions to problems, as we were just talking about with the housing thing, that's not something that the common man is really going to have an opportunity to fix, maybe for themselves, but definitely not on the large scale. But as far as like our everyday problems that we deal with, the healthcare issues, things like that, I think that when people... When it affects them directly, when somebody, you mentioned that your family had issues with the housing thing, when something affects a person directly, they have much more of an incentive to find a solution to it, and the fewer bad options that they have available to them, meaning government involvement, the more likely they're gonna be to obtain a successful result. If that makes sense. And I think when you look at focusing on community rather than on government programs, like we were talking about with the food pantries and stuff like that, I think that provides a solution. And I think it's something that would come to people pretty easily if they don't have the, what's a good way of putting it? If they're not acting like cats chasing the laser beam on the wall, which is known as government programs. If they don't have the stuff available, if it's failing miserably, they see that, okay, here's how we fix this. We get together and we work with the food pantry. We collect donations from our neighbors and take it to the central point, and those that need it, they can go over there. Those that have extra, they can donate, or they don't donate, whatever. So what are your thoughts on that, Callan? Have you seen it in action?
Yeah, we had a couple of friends here in Richmond that help participate in giving out a lot of food over the weekend, and that's always a good way to go about helping people. I help tons of people all the time here, economically finding a place to live, staying here at my place until they can find a place to live, helping them find jobs, countless of ways. But yeah, I think community comes first. I think that's a great way to go about doing it. That means, you know, not to be like an Oscar Grouch kind of person, right? Funny they bring it up, though. I know we talked about it last time, but I think it was like over the weekend that some volunteers got arrested for feeding the homeless again. And in California,
that's an ongoing topic,
right? Yeah. So talk about wanting to help your community again, and it just won't stop. About a dozen people got arrested, facing misdemeanor charges for giving out food for the homeless. So, you know, it goes back towards what we're saying. The last thing that people want is that kind of ability to help each other. You know, I guess for them, again, without licenses, without permits, but without government, that's essentially what's going on there.
Yeah. And let me throw something out there. For those that don't know this, I have been homeless before. I spent a couple days short of 9 months in a homeless program a number of years back. So it's not that I lack compassion or even understanding of the situation. It's not that I lack empathy. My opposition to what is passed off as help is because of my empathy, is because of my experience dealing with it. And quite frankly, what I've seen that is passed off as being help is probably more destructive than the issues that brought people there. Because for the most part, particularly when you look at the welfare system, it doesn't help poverty. We covered this probably in the first segment, that when the welfare system really kicked in is when poverty started increasing. Poverty was decreasing on its own prior to the Great Society, and then it started going back up again shortly after the programs really kicked in. So it's not a lack of empathy. So anyway, we'll be back.
Worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Cell 411 is a great free app for Android and iPhone. It allows you to set up public and private cells for dealing with crime, emergencies, setting up neighborhood watch, activism, and even protecting your kids from bullies on the street or at school. Cell 411 gives your cells turn-by-turn directions to your location with one touch on your phone. There is also a Bluetooth panic button available that can be worn on your wrist, belt, or around your neck. Cell 411 has real-time chat for each alert so you can discuss the incident with family or friends in real-time video streaming. The video is stored on Cell 411's servers so your evidence cannot be deleted if your phone is taken or destroyed. Cell 411 has decentralized ride sharing that allows for payment in any form, crypto, barter, silver, cash, etc. Cell 411 does not take a cut of your fare. Get Cell 411 free on Google Play and the iTunes Store, or go to getcell411.com. That's getcell411.com.
Freedom Fiends. This is Lou and Cal, and we're talking about talking to communists. Their preconceived notions, their ignorance, their false beliefs that because something exists, because a government program exists, is providing a solution. And now we're going to change from beating up the left-wing commies to beating up the right-wing commies and talk about the police and military. Now, Cal and I are the only two military veterans on the show here. Cal was in the Air Force, and I was in the Army. Cal, how long were you in the Air Force for, and what was your MOS? What did you do?
I did security forces for 4 years, from 2004 to 2008.
Okay. Did you have any overseas deployments, Iraq, Afghanistan, anything like that?
I guess part of Operation and Terrorism or something like that. Yeah, I went to Akrotiri Rural Air Base guarding spy planes.
Alrighty. Did you do any POW handling?
Oh, no. We did a lot of training for that.
Okay. All right. I went in. I did a total of 9 years, three enlistments. But anyway, I went in at the end of the Cold War. And I was stationed over in West Germany. Back then, we did call it West Germany. By the way, I started off as a cook and eventually got trained on interrogations and became a German linguist. But anyway, I went in at the end of the Cold War, stationed in West Germany. I was there when the Berlin Wall came down. And obviously, I was there before and after it came down, because it only came down for like one day. But interestingly enough, I remember the conversations that we had, and by we, I mean me and the fellow soldiers I was stationed with in the area. And we talked about how horrible things were in East Germany. And for those of you that don't remember East Germany, it was a socialist state, meaning the government controlled the means of production. It owned and controlled the means of production. Here in the USSA, the government just controls it through all of its declarations and dictates the ownership. Well, I'm going to quote Reagan from his 1964 speech. If the government has the control over it, it doesn't matter whose name is on the deed. That's paraphrasing what he said. So essentially, the government acts like it owns everything. It lets you have the title and pay rent on it, but they're the actual owner. So it's not a whole lot different from the former East Germany. But one of the big things that we always thought was horrible was that the Minister for Staatssicherheit, also known as the Stasi, or the Ministry for State Security, or early version of Department of Homeland Security for the German Democratic Republic, they would go out and tap the phone calls of their citizens. Sometimes they were targeted. Sometimes it wasn't targeted. Sometimes it was just phishing, looking for somebody that was disloyal. And they would intercept letters and read the letters. And this is back in the days when you had to actually go tap a phone. You had to physically tap a phone. You couldn't push a couple buttons on the computer. And you also have to remember, they're using socialist technology of the 1980s. So it wasn't exactly high-speed stuff. They had to actually go to a building, tap the phone, listen to it, push the button on the recording device, which was usually some sort of cassette tape of some sort, and they had to actually intercept letters through the postal service, open them up, read them, figure out what's going on. And the mission was to keep all the police and surveillance state of East Germany and in the Soviet Union from coming to America. And interestingly enough, there was just a bill passed, I think, in the Senate, expanding the power of the government to wiretapping of American citizens without warrants. So they've granted themselves more permission to get closer to what was going on in East Germany. So when I look back at what we did for our service, particularly my generation, by the time you got in there, it was all new tyranny that was coming on. But I guess the only way that I can say that I succeeded or that my service made a difference is it's not the Stasi and the KGB that's spying on Americans now. It's the NSA that has brought the police and surveillance state.
There's a really good film that came out that deals with that region that you're at. It's called Goodbye Lenin. Have you ever heard of it?
No, I haven't.
Directed by Wolfgang Becker. And it came out in 2003, and it takes place in East Germany. The synopsis is would be the reunification is about to take place. The Berlin Wall is about to fall down. But before that happens, this kid's mother gets a heart attack from stress, see him at an anti-government protest. And the doctor tells him that if she incurs any kind of stress, anything that's traumatic, because she's just waking up from a coma, she could die. So while she's in a coma, the wall falls down. And when she comes to, she doesn't know that the wall has come down. She still thinks there's communism, that is still East Berlin, that there's no reunification that's taking place. So the kid has to rearrange their home to make it look like it's East Communist Germany again.
Oh, God. So in other words, he takes all the food out of the refrigerator.
Yeah, he does. He does. They have to go back. They have to take out all the new spices, all the different like new furniture that's come in. They have to highlight the windows because you see like a Coca-Cola sign moving up. He has to create fake news segments with his friend to put on the television for her. It's an ordeal.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
I won't ruin the rest for you though, but it's such a good film. It's hilarious. It's really well done.
Where can we find that?
It's called Goodbye Lenin, and you should be able to find it online for free. I have a DVD that I got from the Foundation of Victims of Communism. They're located in D.C. They sent that one for me because I showcased it here to my community a couple months ago as like a film critique. But yeah, no, it's funny that you mentioned that.
I've got to look for that. Yeah, but here's the thing. In the land of the free, the NSA has been doing what the KGB and the East German Stasi was doing to their citizens. If you look at the number of people that are arrested for economic transactions, meaning, I'm not even talking about illegal drugs. I'm talking about they're out peddling and they don't have all the permissions and licenses that a free person is required to have to engage in commerce. They haven't pleased the crown by paying tribute to get permission to engage in commerce. They don't have their numerous inspections from multiple different agencies to do all these different things. So what the American version of the KGB is doing is they're going around and they're crushing the remnants of private enterprise in the free market. And by the American KGB, I mean local cops are going out doing code enforcement. The ones that are enforcing bureaucracy. The Soviet Union didn't collapse. It just folded up its tent and popped up here in the USSA. And yeah, you still have the semi-private ownership or private rental of property, but no, you don't own it. And if you need a permit in the land of the free to engage in the most basic things, the most basic activities of putting food on your table, then how can you call yourself free?
Yeah, a lot of people like to think that the police and the military are like very distinct. You know, you see a lot of these old television shows, and
they're on our side. They don't, right. They don't blame them. Blame the politicians. Well, you see any politicians kicking in doors? You see any politicians kidnapping people? No.
Right. And even if you look at the background and history of policing, going all the way back to Sir Robert Peel, I think it was like early 1800s, like 1823 or something like that. When he established state police-funded policing. But they forget that police force was modeled after a militarized unit in Ireland, keeping people down. It's like pretty much a military law there. So even the history, because all the police here in the United States is inevitably modeled after Britain, right?
Yeah.
And so coming back from that and the history of the police here being able to be traced to Robert Peel's modernization of policing there and him modeling that after a militarized group in Ireland keeping people down, it's like, well, then the history of the police is from the military, right? So that's just a military that they keep here in State House to keep everyone else down from rioting and uprising.
Here's a question. If the police and military defend freedom, then why is freedom disappearing? And I'm asking all these right wing people that have desecrated the American flag by putting a thin blue line on it. If these people serve the public, if they are your servants, if they are your employees, then why are they taking orders from the politicians that are saying that they can steal from you? That they can surveil you without even a warrant. I mean, for God's sakes, it's not like it takes a whole lot of effort to go to your coworker and get written permission to spy on somebody or to search their property. So, how do you people justify this? That freedom is disappearing. That engaging in commerce, you know, that free market thing that you Republicans are always talking about. You know, how do you justify a free market where you have to jump through all these government hoops and you could be arrested for providing a service to somebody, or you could be arrested for earning a living and putting food on your table for your family and a roof over your head and not being on food stamps because you're providing for yourselves. How do you people justify that in a free country?
I think on the side of that, and when we're talking about like history, there's a lot of things about policing that people don't know so much about here, particularly. You know, one of the largest group of that provided security and investigation was the Pinkertons. And they outnumbered the entire military forces, armed guards, and you never heard of them like taking over cities and counties or anything like that. They did their job really well, so very well, in fact, that the government passed laws to outlaw them because they were setting up a competition of the FBI. And that's the history and source of where the FBI came from the Pinkertons.
Yeah. Well, I think they also eventually became the Secret Service.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We'll be back.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
I love the Freedom Fiends, but in this modern busy world, I just don't have time to listen all the way through every episode.
There is a solution. Go to the World Wide Web and log on to digest.freedomfiends.com and subscribe to the Freedom Fiends Digest. Digest.freedomfiends.com has 20-minute best-ofs of each episode.
20-minute best-ofs? Digest.freedomfiends.com sounds great. How much does it cost?
That's the best part. It's free. And if you listen at 1.5 speed, they're only 13 minutes long. Plus, the episodes are only about 15 megs, which is great, because I have a limited data plan.
Wow. I'm at digest.freedomfiends.com right now. It's so simple to use. And anyone who doesn't have 13 minutes to listen to the Freedom Fiends is a big old statist.
I agree with you about people who can't find 13 minutes to listen to the Freedom Fiends Digest. That's digest.freedomfiends.com.
Freedom Fiends, final segment. This is Lou and Cal. So why did you not stick it out and become a lifer? Why did you leave the military?
Well, I always knew I was going to do 4 years in the military. The military is definitely a place where, you know, they're looking for yes people, and every aspect. It's not a place for anyone has any divergent opinions or, you know, thinking, you can say. Which is kind of, you could see maybe that's what you want in the military. You want people to just kind of follow orders. But even my friends and family knew that. You know, what are you doing joining in? It's the complete opposite. But one thing I did, you know, growing up, I've never had a fondness for cops. My first experience with cops was just a horrible, bad experience. And one way for me to understand it was joining the military and becoming a military cop. But one thing I never did, though, while in the military was write a ticket. Because at least if you're a civilian cop, there are quotas. That you have to fill out, otherwise you get fired.
There are no quotas. They call them something else.
what a civilian? Oh, yeah, they don't call them quotas. Yeah, that's right. In Chesterfield, they said the same thing, but then, like, a guy got fired for that.
Right.
But in the military, you have a contract, right, for 4 years. And so you can't get fired if you don't write tickets. So I never wrote a ticket. I could never really justify it because I was very Kantian. So, like, you know, I can't write a ticket for someone who's speeding because I like speed too or go through a stoplight because I do the same thing. And so, you know, that was not particularly appealing for a lot of the supervisors. And it's not a place for, if you want to go for life, or most of the people that know they go for life are usually ones that don't have much of anything else going on for them. And they find the military is an easy way to get money for not doing much of anything else. Because you're not really doing much at all. It's not a place where you actually are kind of working, you can say. It does take up a lot of your social life, does take up a lot of your time. You know, 4 years gone that, you know, you work 16-hour days and not much room for anything else except for sleep and going back into the meat grinder.
Yeah, I was open to staying in and making a career out of it. I think when I first went in, I was set on doing my 4 years, get my college fund, get out. I certainly enjoyed my time overseas. I enjoyed being stationed in Germany. I learned the language over there. I learned more German talking to German people than I did in any classroom. And I'll include grammar in that also, because I did have a friend that sat me down and he worked on orthography, and that's proper pronunciation and having the proper dialect and accent. And my crowning achievement was when I could fool native speakers in basic conversation. Back at the time, I didn't get out because I became an anarchist or anything like that. I did become disillusioned with the nonsense that goes along with it, the bureaucracy that comes from a very large organization was really unbearable. There's a lot of people that get out because it's just a hassle. But also, when I got out, it was 1999, so it was pre 9/11. But when I had gotten out, there was the Bosnia stuff had been going on. Black Hawk Down had happened in Somalia a few years before, and it was Desert Storm was kind of like dipping the toe in the water. Desert Storm turned out successful because the U.S. military didn't stay in Iraq and occupy and try to do what was done in 2003 with that invasion or in Afghanistan. It was a get in, get out. And the public became enamored with war again because, unlike Vietnam, it was a success. It was quick. The propaganda flowed wonderfully. The news coverage, there was very little resistance to the war in the news. The people that were protesting were not featured prominently. You didn't have opposition opinion out of newscasters. So the fourth branch of government did their job and they sold it. But when I looked at what was going on, and I says, how is all this stuff making America safer? And it wasn't. It's just like cops. Okay, do cops keep you safe, or does your Second Amendment and taking care of yourself, being self-sufficient, keep you safe? Are you your own first responder? So the right-wing commies are just as disillusioned and delusional as the left-wing commies. Sorry, but I have to drop some truth there. All right, thanks for coming on tonight, Cal. Thanks to everybody for listening. For more Freedom Fiends, go to freedomfiends.com. And Cal, what's your website?
You can go to liberaterva.com. Stay liberated, friends.
Worms.